Hi, and welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Chris Lucian, and I'm joined by my co-host, Austin Chadwick. And today we're going to be talking about mob planning. And so, Austin, what are your thoughts on mob planning?
Thank you, Chris. So this topic jumped out to me a lot because I came from very traditional environments, very traditional waterfall, and then did kind of scrum from scratch. So went from traditional waterfall to scrum, and that was pretty fascinating. So, I mean, obviously in waterfall, when you do planning, it's a lot of planning up front, a lot of documentation. And then, so it's like everything's phased out, right? Then a lot of coding and then a lot of testing and all that. And so the planning was a ton. And then when I transitioned to scrum, I felt like it was a great improvement over that, where you would only plan, like, for example, 2 weeks at a time or something like that. And that felt great. And then I think I first realized how a mob would do that when at a previous place I was at, we had someone who used to mob program with you, Chris. And I was bringing him on board, and I was saying, like, hey, so we do the sprint planning thing. And then he's like, oh, this is what we used to do when I was in a mobbing environment. And the meeting flipped from me explaining to him how we do. I was just like, tell me how you do this. Well, how about this? And so what I kind of learned is kind of the principle, and then now mob programming for quite a while now, I've experienced it. It's a kind of a lot of the spirit of the same things, but it's just a lot more lean, I think, right? So so it felt good to not plan a whole project for a year out, to chop that down to 2 weeks. And I kind of feel like with mob planning, it is chopped like really, really, really thin, so to speak, in my experience. And yeah. I guess that doesn't necessarily come along for the ride with mobbing. I suppose you could be mobbing in a waterfall environment. But maybe that's a question back to you, Chris. Like, what led mobbing to necessarily be planning in much smaller increments?
So people advocate for small planning periods or a set planning period. When Woody was originally working with us, he obviously was like a big advocate for lean. I think, though, that there is a natural occurrence with mobbing that I think isn't given enough credit. Mobbing amplifies everything, right? So if you're being successful, mobbing makes you more euphoric with your success, right? And so it's like, hey, we refactored, that's great. But it also amplifies waste, right? So, like, if you are in a meeting and you're planning a meeting and you're kind of one-on-one just saying, okay, we're going to do this and do that, then it feels more wasteful to go through the actions of that planning meeting, or maybe your whole mob has only one thing to contribute to that discussion rather than four people having four things to contribute and learning from each other. So I think longer planning meetings actually have more value in individual workspaces and have less value in mob environments, because what'll happen is everybody's already synchronized and it'll just feel very wasteful to have four or five people there, just basically there to communicate one thing. And so I think that there's a lot more pain in those planning meetings, that therefore makes everybody accepting of lean practices, where I think before people would be like, hey, I really want to just learn about what that person over there is doing and that person over there is doing. This is my only place to see that. And so, things like planning poker and other bits where you're saying like, this is what we're going to do next and this is how we're going to organize it and everything like that. I think it just, this whole thing of just doing Kanban vertical slices and evaluating based on cost of delay, I think a lot of that came in. And I think it also has a lot to do with the no estimates practice as well. But if you combine all of that, then you get this really lean and efficient, this is the next feature we're going to do, it's done. This is the next feature we're going to do, it's done. And also you get that nth degree of agile where you can just turn on a dime whenever you want to. And so I honestly think, like, the reason that shorter planning sessions became more and more accepted was because as a mob, it feels more and more wasteful to spend more time in meetings, and where you could just be programming once you have the available information. And that that becomes pronounced and people bring it up. And so your meetings become shorter and shorter when you start mobbing.
Yeah. And you're right. I think it is a combination of a whole bunch of practices that mobbing makes it easier to do. So I guess two more things come to mind. One is, I noticed when we were at previous places doing 2-week sprint planning, it was like planning the first day or so was easy. And that was typically pretty right. You know what I mean? It'd be like, hey, you know, we have 10 people, you're going to do this, I'm going to do that, you're going to do this, and then it'll kind of work out. But then once you start getting into like day 5, you know, week 2 of the sprint, everyone is just wild guessing and the whole world has changed by then anyways. And yeah. So, I mean, it was really bad when you had like a year long project plan for whatever, right? But even within 2 weeks or short increments, I feel like there was a lot of waste that was obvious to everybody, but it was just like, oh, well, this is what we do. You know what I mean? You write out your cards for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then you put them up on the board. So that had a lot of effects. And so within a kind of day-to-day mobbing environment, at least for me more recently, it's like we do just enough planning to make the next step, right?
Yeah.
To make an informed decision about the next step. So we often are diagramming, right? And so we'll just be like, okay, well, we're going to do this thing in the front end. And then, oh, that means you got to do this in the back end. And, oh, what does that mean about this thing over here in the cloud? And then we'll kind of draw that out and be like, okay, that's probably enough to get started. Anybody have anything else? Nope. And then you just start working. Yeah. And then you discover as you go, right? You discover the work as you're doing the work kind of thing. And so I think another thing I was going to say was, one thing that mobbing does that I didn't really think about that really impacts planning is the technical practices, right?
Yeah.
So I've been at places where you have a big push for more agile-like planning, but then you keep the technical practices the same, right? So you're doing things in huge batches and there's not tests, so there's not safety, and you have these huge pull requests, and so it makes it where the code's hard to change. It's hard to shift. You know what I mean? It's like once you start on a feature, you have to spend the next 2 weeks finishing it, and there's no way to like stop where you're at and move to something else. And what I've noticed is when we're mobbing, there's usually like a clean code or type person in the room who always makes it doable to finish every increment, and you can push that increment to production and then switch cards if you have to, right? So if the product owner comes, hey, I know what you're doing is important, but this new thing just came up. Instead of being like, nope, you got to wait for us to finish for 2 weeks, or we put that on the shelf and there's all this code waste of like things in inventory, right, that we have to like merge later. You just don't have that, right? Because everything's really like, hey, we did a little bit of value, we pushed to production, we can keep doing what we're doing, or we can switch gears if we need to.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a big thing. So this is like the vertical slices, cost of delay sort of planning. I think it's actually possible in any environment, and I'd be happy to hear of experiments that people run. Maybe leave comments if you can. And for the situation where, you know, even if you're working solo, if you still did cost of delay and vertical slices and you had full stack, it'd be possible. I think it's just a lot easier in a mob because you're much more likely in a mob to have the capability of going through the entire stack and making a full feature from beginning to end because you have all the skills right there. And that's kind of like goes to the efficiency paradox and things along those lines, just the lean concepts of single piece flow. And then I also think that the peer pressure is higher on things like code quality. Like you said, you know, you could go into a code base on a mob and just be like, oh, how can people live like this? Can we just take a minute and refactor this? And everybody will be on board. But if you're solo and your main motivation is like, I need to get this feature out, this is what I said during the planning session, I'm just gonna work around all this other crust as fast as I can. And then I'll release it and then I'll ask for refactoring time later, but then some big priority will come in and then you'll never end up doing it, right? And so, the social anxiety of being by yourself trying to talk, you know, basically to your product owner saying, hey, I need to spend time not on a feature, please let me do that, versus having kind of like a support group with you, clean code becomes natural and easier, and you can teach each other about it, and you know, especially if you have an advocate in the group, then it starts to really accelerate, because a lot of people just won't do clean code practices until they've seen an example of it. But, you know, their personal lives at home are too complicated to actually spend time learning it outside of work. And so literally work ends up being your only place where you can learn it. And a lot of solo developers just won't end up learning it because they don't do a lot of these activities.
Nice. Yeah. And so what I've noticed is that, this is going to come to a story that, you and I had working together in one time was, that when with mobbing, the planning is less formally like planned on the calendar, so to speak. And so it's not like, hey, every Monday from five to, or from one to five, we do our sprint planning. It's more ad hoc, right? So it's like, okay, the product owner or the business is saying they want this, this is their top priority thing. And then, so we'll work on it. And then when that thing runs out, we meet again and find out, okay, what's the next top priority thing to work on? And I think it was a really good learning moment for me once where I was on a mob. And I think I had pretty good down the getting what the product owner wants, right? Mm-hmm. So it was, you have a person from the business, the stakeholder, representative of the product owner, and putting up on the wall of cards, hey, here are all the amazing things we'd want to do. So they come to us with all these ideas and they'll be like, all right, what's the top 5 to 10? We put them all up on the wall and then we discuss them and we keep rearranging them until we get to the top one, right? And I felt very proud of myself, but it was a really good learning moment where I think you came in and you were like, well, that's great that that's what the product owner wants, but is that what really is gonna, you know, drive revenue for the company or provide value for the customers? And so I think that's where you started talking about cost of delay. Do you mind going in that a little bit more?
Yeah. So this is more along the lines of like the no estimates or low estimates the theory sort of stuff. But, you know, basically cost of delay will be, you know, from now until the time that we have the feature, how much will it cost us per day as an organization to not have this feature, right? And some of them are time bound and, you know, but you don't really want to get into like estimating it. So like, the CD3 calculation is a cost of delay calculation that takes into account estimates. So we don't use that, but it's also an option, right? CD3 is like the cost of delay, except it takes into account projections and forecasting. Either of those are a better option than just saying like, here's a roadmap and we're done. We're never going to change direction, right? And so, because a lot of, you know, basically a lot of waterfall organizations then bring on Scrum or something along those lines and just some sprint interval. And then they just waterfall in sprints. Right. And it's like, okay, well the product owner said a year ago that we needed this next. So we're going to do this next. So like that's not agile. That's not what you want to be doing. That's not what Scrum says you should be doing. And so, you know, basically the idea is that as you get in, and maybe we need to link to my blog for this one, but I have a flow chart of how to decide on what to do next. But it's this idea that the next thing that you get in, you basically say it's a feature, it's prioritized against all other projects, and what's the cost of delay? And prioritize based on cost of delay, then evaluate. And what you do is you immediately begin work on it, and you discover the you work through the known unknowns. So that means like, you know, technology development projects or something along those lines, just pure R&D, right? You work for the known unknowns, then you start working on building the feature until you discover a unknown unknown. You then do your R&D on the unknown unknown until you can finish that. If you can finish that, Kanban the feature, release the feature, and then loop back again. If you discover you can't do it, then abandon it and loop back again, right? It's a very simple flowchart, but it basically handles just all of the incoming work. And, you know, basically there's a practice, you know, that is kind of like same sizing, like basically just, this is a form of estimation as well, but like if you bring it down to as small as possible, right? You can say as small as possible, or you can same size, right? And this is like the estimates, no estimates. I'm trying to cater to everyone here. And so in the same scenario, you can either same size or you can do one or the other, and then you put a cost of delay on those things as well. And so so using cost of delay or CD3 and same sizing or small as possible, in each of those scenarios, you can accomplish this idea of like turning on a dime, which is you don't take on Kanban thrashing, right? Like you don't thrash your Kanban. You basically say, I'm going to do one thing at a time. I'm going to get it all the way to production. And you do this form of cost of delay prioritization. And the combination of those makes it extremely lean, right? Like you were saying, you get into a meeting, you say, hey, product owner, like this is what we just did. What should we work on next? The product owner says, wow, this is great, or no, this is not quite right. Here's the next priority, and then you steer. And obviously your product owner is not gonna be available all the time. So you might have like a micro queue of features that it's like, hey, if I don't get back to you, then you know, please work on these things until I get back, and then you just get those into the Kanban. Or what we like to have more is the product owner be available all the time. So in many of our teams, we have this currently, is the product owner is available anytime. We're done with the feature. We have it go through the pipeline. It's in an environment where we can say, like, is this what you were really thinking? Do we need to iterate on this design a little bit more? Or is this good to go to production? A lot of times it'll just be in production in the same day. It's a really great feeling to have something that you like made that morning be in production by after lunch, right? And that's kind of, you know, what you'd look for. And then not only that, but the product owner, by the time lunchtime runs around, you can actually introduce a new feature as well. And so that frequent, you know, release cycle goes. But, you know, I've been part of mobs that have released 2 to 3 times a day to production, even for different product owners. And it's worked very well. And a lot of it just says, bring it down as small as possible, put a cost of delay on it, prioritize the top one. Or if you have many different product owners, this is another scenario I've been in where you, and Austin, I think, has also worked on this team as well, is, you know, 20 different product owners and they all need something. And so what you do is you just time slice and just say, okay, what's on your Kanban? What's on your Kanban? What's on your Kanban? What's on your Kanban? I've gotten to every one of my product owners, go back to the first product owner and say, what's on your Kanban now? And a lot of these scenarios just I've seen be very successful for us.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. It's such an incredible feeling, feeling the difference between the two worlds. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think there's a lot of roles and a lot of like agile frameworks or waterfall frameworks where your job is to basically plan the future. Right. And so you're like adding acceptance criteria for things that may not happen for months. You're finding out details of this or that. You're kind of adding in all the detail. You're asking a lot of what if questions.
Yeah.
When in reality, we don't know what it's going to be like in a couple days, couple weeks, you know, or whatever, right? And I've always noticed, even in the mob programming environment, when we do let ourselves stray from what's needed right now, we start talking about, well, what about if this thing? Well, once we're done with this, what about this thing? It's funny how often, even if we only spend like 20 minutes talking about it with the stakeholders, how often that whatever they thought was for sure going to be the next thing after whatever we're done with becomes like the 10th thing or the thing we never talk about again. It just changes so rapidly.
Woody would always tell me, you know, maximize the amount of work not done, right?
Yes.
And we had a nice to have bag, and we had, you know, when we were mobbing in person, we'd have these physical cards and we just put everything in the nice to have bag. And like, yeah, we'll get to that when it's like the next priority. We'll just go through and review the bag. And I can't tell you how many hundreds of cards we ended up just throwing away or throwing axes at, I think is what we ended up doing to them. But it was all work that just was never done. And it never needed to be done because it never had any value. But in a traditional, you know, in a sprint environment, that work definitely would have gotten done. In a waterfall environment, you know, we would have been so far off the mark. We would have just been, you know, drowning in maybe debt of some kind, maybe like UX debt, I guess, maybe that would be a good way to put it. But, you know, I like to, in my mind, I think, you know, what we have right now is kind of some balance between like the Lean UX book, like using Lean UX to iterate on customer ideas before they are like have software developers on them, but then also combine that with continuous delivery. And you have like this like Lean UX cycle, and then that cycle then yields something that then gets built into a real UX production, a real, you know, tactile thing you can manipulate. And then that feeds back in on itself. And that cycle has been really awesome. And so features that just don't exist and need to exist, they get in there, and then we get some feedback on them over time. And then we come and revisit them much later when we've dealt with other higher cost of delays. And what you get is, you know, one, the developers are spending more time writing software rather than being in meetings. Two, you get a more agile product, and three, the UX is not like overthought or overworked, right? And so rework and overproduction are part of the seven deadly wastes, right? And so in lean software, you want to make sure, you know, all of these things lend themselves to it. And so like a mob, you know, has a very like a lean essence to it, because waste is amplified and it makes it very noticeable. And that's, in my mind, that's where the mobbing really helps with dealing with lean.
Yeah, definitely. And what you were saying helps bring more of the experiment mindset to product planning and product development, where instead of like, I know what the customers need, I have a plan, here you go, customers. It's kind of more like, we have an experiment idea to run on the market. Let's implement it, push it to production, get data and analytics on it, and then shift off that, right? And yeah. I think that's a hard transition for many, I think. But I think it's much closer to reality of how the world really is. We think we know about our customers, we can prove it to be wrong so many times. Yeah.
Your competitive advantage is all your learning ability, right? So like what ends up causing more learning is actually getting something out there. And so, you know, you could have a really like rock star product owner, and they might get it right every time. And it's great to know that. But if you're just making that assumption and you don't have any like validation against that, then you might believe that you're going in the right direction when in fact you're going in the exact opposite direction. And so the difference here is that you just have, you know, just like software developers write unit tests to verify that their code actually does the thing that we said it would, or even manual testers verifying the code does what they said it would. The product owner also needs a level of market validation, you know, and so it's like validating assumptions is just a lot of what we're doing here.
Yeah, for sure. And challenging the product owner was a good learning moment for me. So, I mean, I think you had a story that helped embed this lesson inside of you. I think at one point where, maybe you can tell that story where you listened to the product owner and then the product never got released.
Oh, yeah. There was a period of time. Okay. So, I think the story that Austin's referring to, I've told him, in the past is, you know, a long time ago, I worked on a product that, and this was, you know, even while mobbing, and we went, basically, we had a really great product owner. Like, this person was just awesome. They were always there. They worked with us very often. They gave us direction. Whenever we asked questions, they had answers. And so we were like, this is great. It would be really nice if we just released this now. It's like, oh, no, we can't release it yet because there's this thing and it's just not being taken care of. And so 3 months of this goes by and we still haven't released. And we're like, okay, well, we really need to just start showing this to other people in the organization. And so we called their boss in and just said, hey, we're going to demo what we've been doing. You know, can we, let's just walk through it. And that person was basically like, this is totally off the mark. Like, there's no way we could use this. And we're like, wait a minute. Like, this is like, we've been just like, you know, beat for beat, we've been in tune with the product owner. It's like, oh yeah, but, you know, this is not what I wanted. And so the product owner actually wasn't validating any of their assumptions against the people that were going to be consuming it. And so that 3 months of work was of mob work, which is very expensive, right? Ended up getting thrown out. And so it was this wonderfully designed piece of software, and it was very clean and maintainable, like hit all the check boxes for UX, UI. We had a great relationship with our product owner, except it was never used in production and never will be. And so, this whole idea of like getting it out there and seeing what your users like, that's an extreme case, obviously, but I've seen it on much smaller cases as well, of like a sprint being released and totally worthless or things along those lines. And so it's always good, just validate your assumptions, right? So like, if you can say it's an assumption, what can you do to validate it? Like, that's just a good practice to live by in general, right?
Yeah, and I think the big take home for me was I think it's kind of a comfort zone to not, to just be like, hey, I'm just the, I'm the, you know, facilitator of the product owner discussion, and I translate your ideas into executable code and we deploy that kind of thing, and not really think about challenging them. But I think to adopt the mindset that, hey, they're human too. They need their own suite of tests, so to speak, as you're talking about before.
Yeah.
And to, so it is good to have that positive relationship with them and to help translate, you know, their big ask into several thin vertical slices of maintainable code, but it's also to challenge them, right? And so that's when we're cost of delay. So I know you've mentioned it a few times. Do you mind going into that a little bit more?
Because
that
concept helped me.
Yeah.
The duration that you don't have the feature, like, so per day, how much does it cost your company to not have the feature? And of course, this is also another assumption, right? Like, this is a market assumption that you're making. And so prioritizing off of that, right? So like if you, and then there's like, you know, time-bound opportunities and things like that. And that's where kind of like the idea of CD3 comes into play. But we just, you're so much better off just doing cost of delay. Like doing CD3 is just something that, like, if you have the ability to estimate that well, then, you know, go for it. But like, just do cost of delay. Like, it just the very simple piece of it. It's like, hey, but it has to be small things, right? Like vertical sliceable things, right? And so, and if it's like a big feature set, and it's like, once we have the whole feature set, let's release it, then you might do it that way. But it's just on average, how much do you believe per day you're losing as a company by not having that feature? Okay, you know, prioritize it based on that, right? And so, you know, basically, you know, a lot of what I got in the past was product owners saying like, well, no, you know, it has to be this whole feature set before it's actually valuable and things like that. But in reality, what ended up happening, you know, in every case that I've seen this happen before, which I've seen it at multiple companies now, is once we just prioritize on cost of delay and release in those vertical slices, it takes a lot less to earn a lot more money than they think. And so, you know, getting that small thing out there ends up just moving the needle so far. And again, minimizing the amount of time and you know, spent doing wasteful activities and maximizing productive value to the customer, and has definitely shifted things to the point where you can overtake competitors and do other things like that. So, it's been so the cost of delay calculation is just real simple. It's like, you know, we'd be making this much more if we had the feature now, and then every day we don't have it, that's how much. And then you just say, for all of our features, what does that look like? Okay, now, and usually to a product owner, it's literally like, you know, it's almost like an instantaneous reaction. They're like, oh, obviously this is the next thing, because this is the one that's costing us the most money not having. And usually they're communicating with the sales group or have like some sort of report coming back from the field and things like that. And so in this space, you just get a good idea, right? You just kind of like, at that point, you just kind of need a gut feeling of what will make the most money, and then immediately validate it, right? And then if you're totally wrong, then you can change your direction. Now, the product owner has, you know, in the book that I mentioned earlier, Lean UX, there's the worldview of the product owner, which is kind of like, you know, customer surveys, feedback buttons, heat maps on applications, and then there's like 10 other things. And so the book's really great at illustrating where that information that you would feed into cost of delay is available, and then just one by one, just feed that in, and the application will continue to grow, but it will continue to gain value. And as you make more and more investments in automating work for other people, it becomes more and more valuable to them, and eventually just grows in usefulness to the customer. And the only way that you can guarantee that you're going in the right direction is by validating that you're going in the right direction.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. To have those tight feedback loops. And then I guess for me, the thing I've been adding to any kind of interactions with stakeholders of the product owner is basically to help break down work and prioritize work is great, but there's also kind of the radical candor step, right? To ask the questions that'd be like, okay, I know you're saying this is number one, But can you explain to me the cost of delay versus other things and why this one is number one? And
that's another like piece of it. So like in a meeting, when a developer is just saying like, yeah, I'm going to work on this next thing, you know, and I think in that particular case that we're talking about, we're talking about a long period of time before the product owner would be willing to release it, right?
Yes.
And so that's the argument, right? It's like driving down a windy road with your eyes closed, right? Like every second that you don't open your eyes, the cost of delay increases, right? Because the likelihood that the road has taken a turn is higher every time you go forward, right? And so every time, you know, your eyes being open is literally the production release. And the driver of the car is the product owner, and the developer is like kind of the engine. And so the longer that you collectively have your eyes closed, the more likely it is that you'll go off course, right? And the purpose of talking to the product owner and saying like, oh, well, you know, is that really, you know, the direction to go, is just to verify that, you know, or, you know, break it down into smaller pieces. How can we release it faster? Like as a team, opening your eyes sooner, right? And then therefore being able to reread the landscape, you know, rather than just kind of going blind, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one thing I've seen time and time again is, you can have kind of these intuitive debates like, well, it's obvious to me that this is better or more important. It's obvious to me that this is better. And it's so amazing to see data just kind of like dismantle a lot of those debates. You know what I mean? Where it's like, as soon as you can get data and analytics and feedback on the field, it can really help. You can be like, oh, I hear you're saying this isn't important, but look at this data where it shows this is a problem for 50% of the users or something like that.
Yeah.
And so you want this information available to your product owners, but it's also good for as a development team to have this data to be part of the conversation. And so, yeah, yay for analytics, as much as it is, you can, it can be very, very helpful. Yeah, I think there's a couple more things I wanted to hit, and I guess it's turning into a big topic. I think another reason why mobbing from a planning perspective can work a lot better is it's easy to say the word, hey, let's work in thin vertical slices.
Yeah.
But to actually do it, like, so let's assume that, you know, we have our data, we've met with the product owner, we got our number one thing to do. But that number one thing, you know, it always sounds small to someone who uses the product or someone who's a stakeholder. But it in fact involves like 10 different pieces, and there's 10 different ways to do it, or there's 10 different pieces to it. So I've rarely seen the number one thing be something that's already really small and easy to do.
Yeah.
And so what I've seen is when you're not mobbing, it's really easy for some people working on it to work on it in a way where it's impossible to thin vertical slice it, right? Where they're doing it in a way where they're rewriting other stuff that the app uses. So now we're like risking taking down the entire app to add this new thing, or it's coupled to all these other things. And so there's just like a thousand little decisions in your programming you make that either are leading you towards a thin vertical slice or leading you away from it very quickly. I don't know, what things have you seen help teams implement thin vertical slices in a way that's actually achievable?
Yeah, I think, you know, one good exercise, right, is to just incentivize or not incentivize, but like just make it known that releasing in shorter periods of time is valuable, right? Because if you have to have the pipeline pass, so this is the idea, like, you know, Yahoo, I heard a talk from Yahoo a long time ago now, that basically had this idea, no humans between the code and production. So like, this is the idea that like your pipeline is going to take everything all the way through, and do all forms of testing, and it's just going to go straight to prod. I think, you know, Etsy and Netflix are known for things like this, right? Continuous delivery platforms that are like full fledged. So there's that piece of it. And then, so if the pipeline is fully automated and you are working on something, right? So like one sign that things are going wrong is if it's like, oh, hey, we're going to just turn off the auto deploy on the pipeline, like huge red flag. that means that you've gone too big, right? And like, you know, at times I'm guilty of it too. Like it, I'm just like, oh man, like we just went way too big here. And then there's kind of like this sunk cost fallacy debate and all that other stuff that happens. But if you bring it down to basically say like, can we push in 2 hours and get a release out there with the thing that the change that we're trying to do? TCRs type, you know, the type of thing that you might see, like the test commit revert, like that brings your, and so it would be like TCPR, right? Like test commit push or revert, right? But this idea that your pipeline should really be running for just about everything that you do. That's important. So like ways that you can do this are putting in feature flags right away, right? And so feature flag so pipeline is the first thing that needs to go in. Then the feature flag is the next thing that goes in. And those things like end up taking you all the way to the production every time. Now you're in a situation where you can say, we're going to do something. It's going to be hidden from the user, but it's actually going to move the code base in the right way. And it's getting exercised by everything around it, right? Now you've done something really small. It's in place for whenever you need to use it next time. You can change direction, right? Your Kanban became really small, right? Like you might make the back end of what is going to be a feature of an API interface, but you know that your changes to the code never damaged anything and operate fine in production. So like, and so, you know, the summation of these many different commits across all parts of the stack will always end up going to production right away. That's the best situation you can be in, because now the time, the pain around like getting the commit all the way out is kind of removed and so on and so forth. So there's quite a bit of stuff that you can operate on that.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, the safety net of the feature flag is huge. And what it allows you to do is, because usually people who are going to use or sell the product you're making are often scared to release something to everybody globally that is half-baked and not working or doesn't have all the right things, right? And so what you can say is like, hey, we're going to turn it off for everyone in the world except you. You know what I mean? And you're the only one who's going to see it in production. And it's amazing how much when you do that, they may have said, oh, you need these 50 things before we turn on to everyone. Now they're saying, oh, you completed the first three? Let's turn on for everybody. That's great. And then we'll just be releasing enhancements after that.
And we see that all the time, right? Like it's a great shift. And it's a really good way to just be like, hey, your customers can have this right now. Like, would that provide you any value? And I can't tell you how many times like somebody in like a sales role ends up telling the product owner they need something right away. It's like, oh, we already built that. Let's just go ahead and release it. And it's just like such an amazing thing for the product, for the customer to be like, you know, ask for it. And then like the next hour it's available to them. And it's just because it was already built, but we hadn't published it yet. Right. And so that sort of stuff is just like magic to users. Right. So those cases end up being really gratifying.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it allows you to, I mean, I like to diagram it out and then draw lines like, you know, not a lot of upfront planning, but like, hey, here are the 50 things they want. I think after the first three, we can draw a line and say like released only to the one person in production and have him try it and see what he says. And often enough, that's enough to release to everybody.
So like Etsy is really famous for this. Cause like, if you go look at any of their talks or anything along those lines, I really love the, they're very public about the fact that they have this feature flagging system that it actually measures the number of users that even have problems, like, you know, errors in production or anything along those lines, and it'll recall the feature automatically or slowly grow it over time. And so to my knowledge, I think that nothing of theirs is just gated. It just goes straight out to the customer all the time. So, you know, there are examples of that. And like, that's a really great model. If you have if you're not feature flagging at all, just like learning how to feature flag at all is really good. And then kind of graduating this idea of like user by user feature flagging and then A/B testing, blue, green, that sort of like environment, you end up kind of growing in knowledge over time. So like, it's not something that you have to like say, oh, we do feature flags now and everybody do it, right? There are definitely small steps that you can take. And I think the first one is just saying like, this piece of the feature is in the app code, but it's not visible to the user yet. And we're going to polish that to production anyway. And that's going to prove to us that the new integrations that we put in the system, even though they're not being acted on, have not destroyed any functionality in the app, mm-hmm. any along those lines that maybe the tests didn't catch or environmental things. What that does from a lean and waste standpoint is if there's an error and it gets back to you through a feedback system, then the developers who worked on it that day. It's not like it's going to be like months later and then they have to go back and figure it out, right? So fixing the error becomes much less expensive in that situation.
Yeah, because there's only one thing that's changed since now and then, right? So yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, before we close out, I feel like I have to ask one more question that kind of feels like the elephant in the room a little bit. Maybe not the elephant you're thinking of, but it's an elephant. But so you hire a team, you have a team of developers, and then all of a sudden you're expected to, this team of developers who know how to write code is expected to know how to interact with stakeholders, gather analytics, break things into small pieces, run discovery experiments to do unknown unknowns. How from a, maybe from a leadership perspective, do you help this kind of product ownership type skills in a mob grow or learn or develop at all if it's not there?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of options, right? Like, so like being a learning organization in general, right, is really good. It's just saying like, hey, we have a problem here and we should address it, right? So, you know, everybody's starting point is where they're starting from. And they're growing from there, right? So like one thing is like, can you adapt to a new need at all in your organization, right? Mm-hmm. So that's number one is like, you know, it's the litmus test of like, can your team learn to do something new, right? And if that is no, because we don't have any time because we're making products, like we're probably in the wrong space. And then from there, you know, that might be training, that might be, you know, self-taught stuff and things along those lines. I think the ideas that come with lean software development in general are really helpful. And so it's basically you need a way to ingest new information and then process it and then have that be part of your day-to-day. Some people are really good at it naturally, but I think there's also steps to it, right? So like a good product owner has good verbal communication skills, right? And it's really hard for that. And a lot of software developers may not start there. And so, you know, like one thing we do is just regular lightning talks and other, you know, public speaking incentivizations, just to even just say like, hey, some of us don't get a lot of practice speaking in front of people. So that's like a skill that we need to learn separately, right? And also just doing retrospectives and other things like, so they're just different levels of mastery that you can slowly attain. And then gradually over time, you gain skills in those areas. And as there's a need, right? So if you have a really good product owner and they're handling most of that, it doesn't really become an obvious need, right? But if you've been in a situation where what your product owner had you write was thrown away, right? Like that's a really obvious indicator that you just need to more frequently verify, right? And so if the product owner doesn't learn it, then the software developers are going to have to learn it, right? And then have that discussion with the product owner and things along those lines. So it just depends on where the boundaries in your organization are and how crossable they are, how safe of an organization it might be. And then from there, building up that, you know, the radical candor, those sorts of things, right? So I think giving good feedback and being able to take like feedback from the heart is such an important skill in any industry that that's the place I would start is, you know, public speaking and giving and receiving feedback. Both those skills are like fundamental building blocks for being able to have a conversation, an honest conversation about where, you know, which way a product needs to go and be that partner that you need to be to your product owner as a software developer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I totally agree with all that. And I think the only thing I'll add before we close is I think in your product development organizations, you need to view the skill of communication and facilitation and product management or lean UX and those kind of things as a skill as important as knowing the tech stack. You know what I mean? So you might be like, oh, it's obvious that no one in this team or this mob knows how to deal with the database. We need someone to switch into that mob and teach these people this. I think it's the same thing with these skills, right? That the same benefit you get from switching mobs and teams where skills kind of cross-pollinate and grow from a technical perspective is the same thing for kind of more communication and product development perspective.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of, you can kind of do the, you see someone come into your team that knows how to do it well, and then you can start doing it with them. And then you can start doing it yourself kind of thing. I think with that, we'll close it out, but like, subscribe, please give us feedback to increase our frequency of our feedback loops so we can iterate on the show. So YouTube, Twitter, find us in all the places, and let us know what we'd like to see, what we can, who to have on the show and all that. So until next time, have a good one, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.